The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone, and welcome to IMC. And if no one's welcomed you yet to 2016, welcome. It's the custom, my custom here at IMC, for the first Sunday talk of the year to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. Down through the centuries, it's been one of the central organizing teachings for people interested in Buddhist practice. The Four Noble Truths being a kind of formulation of a way to approach practice, approach our lives. And it seems to be quite brilliant, the way it's put together, partly because it's so amenable to a variety of different interpretations. It seems very useful as a way of applying these formulations into our life in different ways. Can people hear okay? It's maybe a little bit louder. So how's that better? Okay. Should I repeat myself or that you heard well enough? So I thought of one way to approach this topic of Four Noble Truths is to tell you a little bit more generally how the Buddha presented his teachings, how he kind of summarized the Dharma. The Dharma is a very evocative word in the ancient world. It meant things like truth. It meant also things like, probably it's the closest word. If we had to translate the word religion into the ancient Buddhist language, probably would use the word dharma for it. It's a very evocative word. It also means teaching. So a spiritual teacher's teaching would be called dharma. Their understanding of life would be called dharma. Kind of, sometimes in certain settings in India, dharma means duty, kind of the way you're expected to behave in your kind of world. And but to look at how the Buddha talked about teaching, it gives us a sense of what he was about, what he was emphasizing. One thing he said about how he taught was he said that what he teaches is evident. He said, "What I proclaim is clear, open, evident and free of patchwork." This idea that it's clear and evident, meaning that it clearly can be seen and meant to be seen directly for ourselves. A very famous, at least in Buddhist circles, description of the Dharma goes like this. The Dharma is well proclaimed by the Buddha. It is visible here and now, immediate, inviting to be seen for oneself, onward leading, and to be personally realized by the wise. And here, this idea again, it's supposed to be meant to be visible. Visible means that we can experience directly, we can know it directly for ourselves, as opposed to believing it or, believing it. As opposed to being a tenant of belief that you'd read about in a book or listen to a Dharma teacher like me and think, oh, this is it, you know, now I understand what the belief is because I've been told that. Rather, it's supposed to be something that you can touch or feel or see or sense directly for yourself. It's supposed to be evident in your experience. A little bit more kind of provocative, perhaps, maybe a little bit more maybe a little mystifying, perhaps, is the Buddha. Once a man came to the Buddha in a confrontational way, and he said, "What is this teaching that you proclaim?" And this is in that kind of context of being kind of confronted that way. The Buddha replied this. Because in ancient India there was a whole culture of debate, so maybe this guy was getting ready for good debate with the Buddha. Tell me what you teach and I'll, stick it to you. And so the Buddha replied this. I assert and proclaim such a teaching that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world. That probably took the wind out of his sails. Such a teaching that concepts no longer underlie a person who abides free of sensual desire, worry, and craving for any kind of identity. So, in direct response to this man, he says that what I teach is not involved in any debate. I'm not quarreling or in conflict with anybody else's teachings. It's not a teaching. The Dharma is not a teaching with which it's not like a belief or a philosophy that we're ready to have a good debate about. You know, is it true? Or, you know, do I have a better teaching than you? Or, you know, your teaching is not so good, but let me tell you about my teaching. That's not what the Dharma is. It's not interesting to hold it that way, as a belief structure that way. But rather, it involves... there are certain concepts that a person no longer, who's engaged in the Dharma, certain concepts or ideas that they no longer operate under. And those are ideas that have to do or drive things like greed and worry, fear, maybe hate, not listed here. And no longer any drive or compulsion to be caught up in the world of sensual, of personal identity. It's fine to have an identity, but many people have a certain kind of anxiety around it, or drivenness, or ambition around it, that often causes a lot of suffering to ourselves and to others. So here the Buddha is talking about, he doesn't have a belief that he can argue, but he is pointing to a possibility of how to be in the world, how to be in the world where we're not caught in concepts, in ideas, in beliefs even. Another time, someone came to the Buddha and had a series of questions he wanted the Buddha to answer. They had to do with metaphysics of its time. Some of them had to do with, is there life after death? Is the world eternal? Is the world finite? What's the nature of the soul? Things like this. And he wanted answers to these questions, and the Buddha declined to answer any of the questions he asked. At the end, he explained why, and he said this. These views are not beneficial, do not belong to the basics of the spiritual life, do not lead, and this is the important phrases in the ancient language, do not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, and to nirvana. So the Buddha was interested in something pragmatic that was useful for a particular purpose. And of these words that I like very much, the word peace. I very strongly identify with peace as a kind of a wonderful way of living in the world with a heart at peace and at ease. The way to that is through a process called disenchantment and dispassion. Disenchantment means that we're no longer enchanted. So I love this idea. Enchanted means you're under the spell of something. And under the spell, for example, of our greed, of our hate, under the spell of identity, of who we need to be and how we have to prove ourselves or defend ourselves, under the spell of consumerism, under the spell of, you know, politics, under the spell of you know, all kinds of this that people get caught in. And so to no longer, to be disenchanted means to no longer be under the spell of these things. Dispassion, the word for dispassion also means to fade, literally means to fade away. And when we get disenchanted with the things that have a compulsive relationship to, then the compulsivity begins to fade away. And that's this word that's translated dispassion, means the passionate drive or compulsion begins to fade away. This leads to peace. So these answers, certain kind of metaphysical questions, to be engaged in those and even to get answers to those, the Buddha holds doesn't lead to this kind of peace. In fact, some people are enchanted by philosophical and religious ideas. Not a few people love reading spiritual books because you get kind of high sometimes. You know, oh yeah, this is great, and wow, this is so inspiring. As long as we're reading, it's pretty good. But does it really lead to disenchantment or to deep abiding peace that you can carry with you when you're no longer inspired? A wonderful teaching from, I think it was Ajahn Sumedho, an English monk in England. He said, if it's not boring, it's not Buddhism. So you all leave now. And how I understand this is you don't want to be enthralled by Buddhism. You don't want to be kind of like think, oh, this is like the best philosophy. This is the most wonderful thing. It's like Buddhism's out there, this thing. It's just, the idea is to know the Dharma just enough to know what the Dharma is. Don't be enthralled with the books and the Dharma teachers and people like that. But rather, the idea is to sooner or later see the Dharma as a mirror for yourself. And really turn around and really see yourself here and see, are you enchanted? Are you caught in the grip of compulsive passion or drivenness, clinging? Are you agitated? Do you live in worry? How is it for you? How are you? And is there a path, is there a way for you to get free, to end up some kind of a deep abiding peace within you? So the Buddha said that the Dharma is something that's visible. And visible means that you can experience it for yourself. You can know it for yourself. And so I'd like to say that here at IMC, if you look around at all the corners and cupboards and closets and different rooms at IMC, you will not find the Dharma. It just doesn't exist here. The only place you find it is in your own heart, is here. How can you see it? How can you touch it? How can you feel it directly for yourself? What is it you can know so that you know the Dharma? What is it that makes a Dharma less mysterious and more obvious for us here and now? So, there's one famous discourse where the Buddha's foster mother, his mother, right, who raised him, comes to him and asks him to teach her the Dharma in brief. So that's nice, She had the inside track. Hey, son, can you just tell me briefly what it's all about? And so this is what he told her. As for those qualities of which you may know, these dharmas lead to dispassion, not to passion, to being unfettered, not to being fettered, to simplifying, not to accumulating, to modesty, not to self-aggrandizement, to contentment, not to discontent, to seclusion, not to entanglement, to aroused effort, not to laziness, to being unburdensome, not to being burdensome. These things you may understand, this is the Dharma. It's a long list of things, but in summary, I'd like to kind of paraphrase it. The Buddha's teaching are those things that lead to dispassion, to being unfettered, to shedding, to contentment, to seclusion, persistence, and to not being burdensome. So the Dharma is found in personal qualities, states of mind, ways of being, how we are in the world, in ourselves. And this is one way we find it. If you're content, in that contentment you find the Dharma. If you're discontented, there's no dharma there. There's no, the religion of the Buddha is not found in being discontent in an anxious way, agitated way. But even more interesting for me is this quote here. When you know for yourself that there is greed, hatred, or delusion within you, and then you know at a different time that there is no greed, hatred, and delusion within you, then you know the Dharma is visible here and now, immediate, inviting to be seen for oneself, onward leading, and to be personally realized by the wise. So this famous quote about the nature of the Dharma, it's visible, immediate, and invites itself to be seen, again, is in yourself. You're invited to take a good look at your mind, at your heart, and what's going on in there. And this is one of the reasons why we practice mindfulness, so we can have a heightened sense of self-understanding to see and feel and know not only the forces within us that are there causing us suffering, but also to know the opposite, to know when they're not there, and to recognize it. And if you can recognize that difference between a mind that's caught in the vice of attachment and clinging, of fear, agitation, and the mind that's free of it, that's where you see the Dharma directly. That's the Dharma. That's, if you want to read the Dharma, a really good book on the Dharma, read your heart. And that's where it's found. It has to be found there. That's what makes it visible and direct. That difference. So it's not like some mysterious, mystical thing that's somehow aloof or transcendent. That certain people have, like those people, they must know really, they have the inside track to what the real truth is. But it's something we can all hopefully access, and hopefully all of you, to some degree, have experienced the difference between being caught up in things that are painful to be caught up in, and then to be free of it, to be lessened, and to feel the difference between that, to feel the relief and the freedom and the peace of not being caught. That's where the Dharma is found, and that makes it immediate, accessible, something you can see for yourself, here and now. And then we have this wonderful term, Nibbana, or Nirvana. And the word Nirvana can lend itself to a lot of mysterious ideas about what the goal of practice is all about. Some people will posit Nirvana as some kind of transcendental realm, state of mind, different reality than this reality. Some people call it the unconditioned. Everything in the world we live in is conditioned or constructed things, but Nirvana is the one thing which is unconstructed, unconditioned, somehow kind of eternal, timeless, deathless, all these wonderful words that kind of make it all seem kind of clothed in wonderful, mysterious, mystical, inspiring language for some people. So here's how the Buddha defined Nibbana. The destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion. This, friend, is called Nibbana, Nirvana. So the ending of greed, hate, and delusion. Or here it's the word is lust in this translation. And these terms, lust, hate, and delusion, greed, hate, and delusion, are kind of seen as the three roots for so much of the inner motivations or forces or clingings that is the basis for so much of the suffering in our world. Our own suffering and also the suffering of the world around us. Probably most of the suffering you read about in the paper, probably a good percentage of it is a source in someone's greed, hate, and delusion. That's been part of it. And so Nirvana is not, again, meant to be something so mysterious, as it's a very pervasive or thoroughgoing uprooting of these afflictive states, these painful states that humans seem to be born into this life with. It seems to be part of who we are, part of the package. And what seems remarkable is that there is a course of practice, of mindfulness, of self-understanding, where it's possible to begin to uproot these forces and be able to experience for yourself the radical distinction between have a mind which is involved in, is driven by compulsivity, by attachment, by fear, by worry, by greed, by hostility, and all the different various degrees and those can appear, to have an experience of mind without that, and to feel that that mind is a valuable mind to have, that heart, it's valuable to have a mind that lessens those qualities. That's where the Dharma is found, and that's what Dharma practice moves towards. So in the classic teachings of Buddhism, one of the central approaches for discovering the Dharma, doing this work, is through the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, the way it's commonly understood, utilize a very common human capacity or understanding of cause and effect. That we often look for, we have something, and it's an issue in our life, and we look for the cause of it. If you have water is dripping underneath your sink, into the cabinet under your sink, you look for the cause. Where is it coming from? So you can fix it and, stop the leak. We look for causes. We look for the cause and effect relationship between things. When I left home this morning to walk down here, I looked at the clouds. And I said, well, these clouds, they mean rain. Are they going to be a cause of me getting wet on the way home today? So we kind of look at the relationship between things. So I think it's a pretty basic human thing to want to do this. And one of the ways to, very simple, ordinary thing to do, is to ask, when I suffer, what's the cause of my suffering? Is there something there that are the conditions for the suffering to arise? There's something that triggers it. Is the suffering the result of something? If suffering was not the result of some cause or some condition, then it would be hopeless to do anything about it. Then you would just have to suffer until reality decided you'd suffered enough. And then you maybe stop for a while. But you wouldn't have any knowledge, understanding why you suffer. You just have to bear it until it fades away. I know that I've done that sometimes. I've had sometimes in my life had certain feelings of depression or sadness or grief or anger. And I couldn't quite get my handle. What was going on? What was causing it? Why was it there? And I thought, well, I think I'll just have to kind of wait it out. And then sooner or later, it generally kind of went away. But I wasn't any wiser because of it. I didn't understand the underlying conditions and cause for why what brought it in. And so then I was subject to it arising again and occurring again. So the Four Noble Truths begin with a very simple analysis or investigation, and that is, what is the cause or the condition for our suffering? And so the first noble truth is the truth that there is suffering. Some people feel it a little bit oppressive that Buddhists keep talking about suffering. And I guess I kind of grew up in Buddhism. So I kind of think, to me the word suffering comes out of my mouth so easy and light. It's like, it's like I don't hardly think about it. It's, just suffering. Because, my whole life has been, not suffering. My whole life has been, in this world of Buddhism and this language. And recently someone told me that for some people who are familiar with the English language, that the word suffering is a really heavy word. And it's like tragedy or, the big, suffering means like big, terrible things. and um, And I just thought it meant everything. Every possible little, you know, from the most smallest little distress or stress or anxiety to the big things. It means the whole gamut. So now I think maybe I shouldn't use the word so much. But I don't know what to use instead. Some people use the word stress instead. They say that because even things of great happiness are stressful. There's supposed to be some statistic that one of the most stressful experiences people have in life is getting married. And it's supposed to be a happy event. So you don't say suffering, you know. That comes later. Yeah. I was told the story of one of the preeminent American Buddhist teachers, Western teachers, who the first time he was invited to officiate a wedding, maybe the last time you hear. He did the wedding. Part of the wedding, you know, there was a little Dharma talk that he gave. And he gave a Dharma talk about death. Yeah, I'm preparing them for everything. So sometimes stress, so I don't know what the word is, but maybe it's better not to translate the word at all and just say dukkha. It's the Buddhist word dukkha. And when I was meditating in Thailand, there was little meditation huts in the woods. There was these kind of geckos that lived in the rafters of the hut. And as far as I could tell, they kept telling me, dukkha, dukkha. Kept being reminded, dukkha. So the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. That there is stress, there is suffering, there's distress, there's unease. Unease is a nice word, way of translating maybe dukkha, unease. But that sometimes is too mild for some compared to some of the big things. But so all those kind of work. And the second truth is that often presented as the truth of the cause or the condition for the arising of this dukkha. And so the first truth, the practice around it is to really understand it. And this is one of the hallmarks of Buddhist practice, is a willingness to take a serious and honest and direct look at the ways in which we feel unease, the ways in which we suffer, the ways that we have stress, to really stop. And so the bumper sticker for Buddhists would be, I stop for suffering. Because it's so important to take a look at it. Because if we don't look at it, we can't learn from it. We can't change it. We can't transform it. So then the second truth is a truth of the, often described as truth of the cause or the condition for the suffering. And this also should be penetrated, understood deeply, to seeing what it is, so that we can let go of that cause. And here's where, what I find so brilliant about these Four Noble Truths is we don't have to put them into, we don't want to define them too closely. The idea is that we look at cause and conditions that affect our suffering and bring about our happiness and well-being. And what is that? That analysis, that look, stop and look. What is it? What's really going on here? What's going on in this picture? In the Buddhist analysis, the cause is generally referred to by a single word. And the word in Pali is tanha. And tanha literally means thirst. And it's a very kind of visceral. Remember, Dharma is something to be known directly for yourself. So you know when you're thirsty. It's kind of a direct feeling. So thirst is, I think of it as a drivenness or compulsivity. To really have a compulsive desire. When we're caught in the grip of desire, any kind of desire, for or against something, and we can't let go of it, we can't be free of it, that being caught in the grip of desire is thirst. And that gripness is said to be the source of our suffering. If we can let go of being in the grip of desire, then we can let go of that suffering, we can be free of that suffering. So part of the Dharma practice is to get quiet enough, mindful enough, to begin noticing what is actually going on in my mind, in my heart. When I suffer, what else is happening here? And the suggestion in Buddhism, which is a little bit outrageous in certain circumstances, is that you would take responsibility for how you suffer, as opposed to blame other people for it. Now, other people, unfortunately, are often the condition for us to suffer, but in the Buddhist analysis, they're not the cause for us to suffer. And that's the outrageous thing. And whether it's true or not, often you're better off anyway taking responsibility. Because then you stop and look at yourself. What am I doing? What am I contributing to this suffering? Because you have a half a chance or a serious chance to do something about it if you're contributing to your suffering that maybe you don't have if someone else is doing it for you. You can't necessarily change other people so easily, but you can't change yourself. Now, of course, you can't. It is appropriate to stop people from harming you, absolutely. But the Dharma practice, again, is always found in what you can see and feel for yourself, taking responsibility here. So then to turn around and see, what am I contributing here? And this word thirst is one of the places to look. Is there some kind of desire for or against something? Something, strong aversion, strong wanting, strong compulsive thinking, something that's kind of churning away, that's kind of like has grabbed you by the neck or grabbed you by, you know, in your mind, so you can't put down. You're attached to it. You're clinging to it. And if it is, then you can just kind of maybe see the connection between the clinging, the strong wanting, and the desire. And if you see that connection, that cause and effect relationship, then the next step would be to ask yourself, do I need to continue to cling to this desire? Am I better off having this desire or not having it? Or am I better off clinging to the desire or having the desire lightly in a simple, easy way? It's a reasonable desire to have, but I don't have to have it. It doesn't have to be now. And so to start investigating, what is the nature of this desire, the clinging, the thirsting? What is it that you're doing? What's your contribution? And is it something that it's possible to lighten up with, to soften, to relax around, and perhaps even to let go of? And in the instructions around these Four Noble Truths, the instructions are to let go of the thirst, let go of the craving that, in the Buddhist analysis, is the source of our suffering. Then the third noble truth is a truth of the cessation of the craving, the thirst, and the cessation of the suffering. And this is, remember, the Dharma is seen when you see the presence of unhealthy states of mind and the absence of unhealthy states of mind. Something about seeing the absence, seeing the cessation, seeing the potential, the possibility of a mind that's free, that's at ease, that's very important for understanding what the Buddha was teaching, what the Dharma is about. It's easy to overlook it. Some people who are caught up in a lot of desire might let go of one desire only to pick up another one right away, because it's getting and having and doing is what's important. But just take time to feel and be present for a mind which is at ease, a body that's at ease, to experience the nourishment of being settled and at peace. For some people, meditation is one way to do that. Meditation, is for some people, as we get into it, is a time where we learn slowly to relax so deeply that we relax, maybe temporarily, the clinging, the cravings, the aversions, the greed, the hates that we have, and the mind becomes peaceful and quiet. And then take time to be nourished by that, to feel it, to experience it. Be changed by it. Realize that it's a possibility. Realize that it has maybe greater value to have that peace than it is to pick up again the attachments we have, the drivenness we have, the identities we're clinging to. It's extremely important for the Dharma practice to have a visceral experience of this kind of release, the mind freed, the mind at ease. It's not easy to do that. So the fourth noble truth is a truth of a series of practices we can do that create the conditions that support this peaceful life, this experience of peace. And three of these, there's eight steps to them, eight practices. Three of them have to do with ethics. It's difficult to be peaceful if you're going around robbing banks and, you know, stealing from your best friends and all these things. You want to be ethical. Not because of Buddhist moralistic thinking that they have to be a moral person, but generally the reason to be more ethical in Buddhism is twofold. So we don't harm other people, and so we don't harm ourselves. We want to create the conditions where the mind can be peaceful, have a clean conscience, so we can settle deeply. So through our speech, through our actions, and through our livelihood, the three areas. We want to have an understanding. The Eightfold Path involves an understanding of what is it that moves us towards peace. It's called the right view. And generally it's understood to be this view that we'd stop to look for suffering, look for its causes, and look for that cessation, or that freedom, or that peace. To really stop and look at that. And the value of that is we're not looking in the wrong places. If we are looking, in other people to solve our suffering, if we're looking at politicians to solve our suffering, if we're looking at crystals to solve our suffering, if we're looking towards, I don't know what, all kinds of things, people look at all kinds of things outside of themselves, then we're not really looking at the heart of the matter, where we can make the more profound change for ourselves, where we take responsibility and grow up to really be able to take and really see what's going on and live a life of taking care of ourselves in a deep inner way. So right view, which is basically the view of the Four Noble Truths themselves, and then there's the right intention. And this has a lot to, a very nice teaching for the beginning of the year. What are the intentions you want to live by? And what the Buddhist analysis is, if you want peace, if you want this freedom that the Buddha is pointing to, you want to avoid not just behavior which is cruel, you want to avoid intentions, motivations that are cruel. If you want to, you want to avoid not just behavior which is hateful, you want to avoid intentions, motivations which are driven by hate or ill will. You want to be free of lust, caught in the grip of that kind of any kind of desire, strong desire. And instead, you want to have intentions of compassion, loving kindness, and frightening word, renunciation. The desire to be simple, to relax, to let go, not hold on so much. And then finally, the last of the Eightfold Paths, last three, have to do with cultivating the mind, developing right effort, making an effort to live more at ease, not caught by things, to cultivate mindfulness so we can have a stronger and stronger ability to see what's going on and right down to the depths of our hearts. And the third, the eighth is concentration. To develop a stable mind, steady mind, so the mindfulness can be penetrating, really effective. So with the Eightfold Path as the foundation, as a support, then it's easier and easier to see how we suffer, how we have stress, how we have dukkha, how we have unease. And we're able to catch it earlier and take it seriously earlier. Not so we can suffer better, but so we can start looking at the causes of it or the conditions of it, understand the cravings and the clingings that underlie it. And then we can let go. Or we can set in place the conditions that allows the letting go to happen on its own. We don't have to be the one always in charge of letting go. The wonderful kind of practices of mindfulness, of concentration, of meditation, reveals a very powerful inner process that can unfold independent of our orchestrating it, independent of us in charge of it all the time. And this is one of the reasons some people find it so amazingly satisfying and profound to be involved in Dharma practice, is that it seems that there's some deep inner or outer, doesn't make any sense, process that goes on that moves us towards spiritual health, that moves us towards freedom, if we can get out of the way. So we learn to be present, we learn to let go of clinging, we learn to get out of the way, and then we move towards, or move into the Dharma. So the Dharma is something that's visible here and now to experience directly for yourself. It's immediate and available. It's not mysterious, but it's something that you can find, that you have access to. And if you understand the basic principle of the Dharma, then what you have is a path that will move you towards freedom, to peace, to well-being, to living in the world in a compassionate way. And the Four Noble Truths is at the heart of this formulation understanding. So I hope that this was a nice way of beginning the new year, and perhaps for this year, if you're interested, you can take this very simple formulation of the Four Noble Truths and reflect on it, learn about it, think about it, and see how it applies directly to yourself. So it doesn't become some foreign idea that someone else teaches, but becomes your own idea because you've seen for yourself how meaningful and effective it is. Great. Thank you.